Good morning. It's good to see you this morning. We are glad that you are here. Well, this is our last study in the book of Romans, and as we have every week as we've been in this series, I want you to join with me in reading together from Romans 1, 16 through 17. Let's say this together. I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. Well, like I said, this is our last study in the book of Romans. Next week, we're going to start into a four-week series on Advent leading up to Christmas, and Bryce is going to kick us off next week, and I know you're going to want to be a part of that. You may remember, although it's okay if you've forgotten because it's been several months ago, but when we started this series in Romans, we actually started at the end in chapter 15 and 16, and we were introduced to a long list of names and all sorts of people that made up the little house churches scattered throughout Rome, the capital city of the empire at the time. And when you start to read through Romans, then one of the things that you see is that even though the number of Christians would have been small at this time, the differences seem to be pretty big. And the disagreements that went with those differences. There were ethnic divisions, as we see all throughout the New Testament, especially Jew and Gentile, but it's also the Romans and everyone else. And there's the economic differences that show up. Quite a few were slaves. Perhaps a few were of decent means. And there's theological differences that show up, which plays out in practice. And Paul spends a lot of time on that in chapter 14, which bleeds into chapter 15. And in the midst of all of these differences, Paul keeps trying to bring these churches and us back to the same place. That is, the same foundation that is drawn on the same faith that we have rehearsed each week over and over and over. All of us are in equal need of the salvation of God that can only be achieved because of Christ's faithfulness and our faith in return. It is not because of who we are. It is because of who He is. And when we realize that common ground, when we realize that all of us are in need, and that all people are invited into the great family of God, then we also realize that the work that Jesus is about is not just about healing our relationship with God, but it is about healing our relationship with one another as well. In fact, what Paul wants to hammer home is this. Even if we're okay with God, if we're not okay with one another, then we're not okay. We're missing something. And so, open your Bibles to Romans 13, and I'm going to read from verse 8, and you'll also see it on the screen behind me. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. It's been a hard few weeks and months for love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, it's always been hard to love your neighbor as yourself. Considering all the differences we may have with our neighbors, considering all the different ways that we would like to define who our neighbor is and who our neighbor most definitely is not. It's been a weird week as far as my alma mater and Paige's alma mater, Abilene Christian University. Abilene Christian University made national headlines, made the news this week. And for those who've graduated from ACU, they know we never make the national news. What could possibly have happened that we made the national news? And then I found out there was a young girl who decided it would be a good idea to film herself while she was impersonating people from other races or another race, put makeup on her face and held up an offensive sign and said very offensive things. And someone else was filming and laughing, howling with laughter in the background. And it went viral in a bad way. Not the good way, but it kept being shared over and over. And so little West Texas private Christian university, ACU, made the national news. And the president of the university sent out a statement. Two students were no longer students. They were expelled. This sort of thing is not acceptable in a university setting, much less one that has Christian in the name. Because as Jesus people, we're called to be people who, if we understand the story and our indebtedness to the love of God, know that love means we love our neighbor as ourselves. Or, Paul says, at the very least, love does no harm to a neighbor. Well, that broke at the beginning of the week. And then in my Facebook feed, I had a friend who made a post. I want to introduce you to that friend. This is Jevin and Michelle Sloan. TJ, you know Jevin, I think. He grew up at our church. I surprised TJ, and he's got a surprised look on his face. He grew up at our church, and I didn't know Jevin until youth group age, when the youth group went to the Sloan's house for a life group, a Sunday night meeting. That was the first time I met him, first time I met his folks. Great people. Well, Jevin went out to ACU, and that's where he met Michelle. So both of them students at ACU, and then I believe he was in the same social club that I was in. He graduated, he went on to Emory and studied law, and now he's a lawyer in Birmingham, Alabama. Great family, doing great things. So he made a post Wednesday that I read and a lot of different people read, and it broke my heart. And so I actually messaged him and I asked, do you mind if I share this with our church because I think it's meaningful? He said, share away if you think it would encourage, it would help other people. And so I want to read to you the post that he wrote. Today, Ruby, that's his 14-year-old daughter, found out that a boy at her school had been telling people he didn't like her because she was, quote, Muslim, and, quote, from Syria. This is the same kid who called her Muhammad a few months ago in front of some classmates. Ruby is neither Muslim nor is she from Syria. Incidentally, he said, this kid goes to our church. But that's really beside the point, he wrote. People seem to have strong opinions about almost everything these days, and I don't really get worked up about people's opinions, but I do get worked up about how they choose to communicate them. Children are listening and processing very complicated topics that their not yet fully developed brains are not capable of processing. Please choose your words carefully. I don't care whose, quote, fault this is, blah, 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 blah. All I care about right now is that I have a 14-year-old daughter who's trying to figure out why some kid at her school doesn't like her solely because of the color of her skin and her perceived ethnicity. And that stinks. And it's very likely because this kid heard an adult say something in a very irresponsible way. I think Jevin is on to something. I don't know who's influencing this young man. But I do know whoever it is has missed one of the most fundamental, it all boils down to this, gospel lessons. To be a Jesus person at its very foundation means this: we love our neighbor as we love ourselves. Or at the very least, love does no harm to a neighbor. And this story breaks my heart in so many ways because no one deserves that kind of treatment and that kind of hate. And it is a tragedy to me that my friend's 14-year-old daughter, who happens to be Christian and American multiple generations, is receiving this kind of ridicule and hate. But church, please do not lose sight of this. This would be just as tragic if this 14-year-old girl being bullied and ostracized and treated hatefully was, in fact, what he said she was, a Muslim from Syria. It is not tragic because he missed who she was, that she's an American Christian. It's tragic because she is made in the image of God. And this is a boy who is being raised in a family who is calling on God. And at the very core of who we are is this story. We love God with all we are. And if we understand what that means, then we love our neighbor as ourselves. Or at the very least, love does no harm to a neighbor. Now, in case you think I'm just getting soft, let me remind you, I'm quoting Paul, who just happens to be, if you'll remember, quoting Jesus. Jesus has an encounter, you may recall. Shows up in three of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Jesus has an encounter with a religious leader, an expert in the law, someone who really knows the Torah. And that man comes to Jesus and asks a question: what must I do to inherit life of the new age? What does it look like? What does it mean? What does it take to inherit, to live in to that life of the new age? Now, interestingly, in Matthew and Mark, it's Jesus who answers the question. But in Luke's gospel, Jesus actually turns the question on the man. Well, what do you think? What does it say? Which is really fascinating because in Luke's gospel, it's this religious expert who gives the answer, 10:27. Well, it means to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus gives him an attaboy. Good answer, good answer. Do this, and you will live. But the guy just couldn't leave well enough alone. And he has one more question. Do you remember his question? Who is my neighbor? Luke tells us the guy wanted to justify himself. The only reason you ask the who is my neighbor question is because you're hoping for a few exemptions. You probably think that you're doing well, and they would have defined neighbor as a fellow Jew, another follower of God, a keeper of Torah. Hey, I'm doing that. And maybe even a few Gentiles who are the God-fearers, who have turned over to Torah, even though they weren't born in this family of faith. I'm doing that too. Who is my neighbor? Because I've got some people in mind. And I've got some exceptions, some exclusions, some people that I don't really want included in this. Who is my neighbor? And you may remember that Jesus often answers in the form of a story. And we get one of the best known stories of all. It is the story of the Good Samaritan. And I won't go blow by blow through the story, but I'll simply remind you there is a man going from Jerusalem to Jericho on a dangerous road. And he is beat up by robbers. They take his stuff. They leave him for dead on the side of the road. And two people come by, expected heroes in the story, a priest and a Levite, a scholar and a preacher. And they walk on by on the other side of the road. And I'm sure they had their reasons, and I know their reasons were probably important. They were significant. But there is one who stops to help, who risks safety, who spends a great deal of money, who makes sure that the man is taken care of, not just in that moment, until he's brought to healing. And the one who stops to help is a Samaritan. And the Jews would have hated that part of the story. They would have hated that part of the story because they hated the Samaritans. They despised these people. They were the half-breeds. They were the other. They were the ethnically tainted, the betrayers of the nation of Israel, and infidels to the faith. So the guy knew that the sum total of the law was to love God with everything you are and love your neighbor as yourself. As Paul says, any of the other commands, don't steal, don't commit adultery, no coveting, it all is summed up. If you get that, you get the others. And this guy knew it. You add it all up and you boil it down to this: loving God, loving others. But he wanted to define neighbor according to his comfort level. Can I pick? Can I choose? Can I exclude? And Jesus turns the question on him at the end. Do you remember? The man asked, who is my neighbor? And Jesus asked, who was a neighbor? Because here's the real question, not who are they, but who are you? What kind of person are you? I've got a friend who's a president of a major nonprofit organization in Dallas called City Square. And it's a lot like River City Ministries, but with about a $40 million annual budget. They do amazing work. Most of the people are in poverty. Some are homeless. Some are trying to help people transition off the streets. Some have no job and need training. And many of them do have jobs, but they're a part of the working poor. It's not the kind of jobs that are helping them get by. And so City Square offers all sorts of things: housing and food and medical and dental and job training and legal and on and on and on. And it is an amazing organization that partners with the people that they help. But one of the things that I love about what City Square does is that they choose their words wisely. For the people that they work with and work beside and help, they have tried to be intentional about their words, much like River City Ministry does. They choose not to describe the people that they're working with first as the poor or the needy or the homeless, because those kinds of words may be accurate, but they don't paint the full picture. And often they color the way we see others, and they can be dehumanizing to these people. And so they've landed on a more Jesus kind of word. And this is the word they always use to describe those that they're working with and helping. They call them neighbor. We're serving our neighbor. We're helping our neighbor. We're walking with our neighbor. We're empowering our neighbor. Because labels matter. Labels impact the way we look at others. And so what if we adopted this way of seeing and talking and thinking, even with those with whom we are very different? What if we use this description? Our neighbors who voted in ways that were very different from us, perhaps disturbing to us or baffling to us. Our neighbors who are different ethnically, our neighbors who might be different economically, our neighbors in the LGBT community, our neighbors who are different religion than us. And not just the people down the road that are Baptist and Presbyterian. I mean, not just those in the same tribe, Christians, but different on a global scale. Because here's what I see Jesus doing and Paul doing. They don't ask us to agree. They don't ask us to understand. We're not even always asked to like. Heavens, enemies are thrown into this picture. What are we asked to do? We're asked to love. The question is no longer, who is my neighbor? The question is, what kind of person are you? Are you a Jesus follower? Because as Jesus followers, we're not given the choice. The sum total of the law is this: love your neighbor as you love yourself. Or at the very least, love does no harm to our neighbor. Now, I've kept saying the very least because I really think the just do no harm is kind of the low bar of love. It's sort of the minimum requirement of love. We've seen a much bigger picture of love. In fact, we've heard it all throughout the book of Romans. And so I'll just refresh your memory on a few of these. It's honoring one another above yourselves. It's sharing with those in need. It's blessing those who curse you. It's living in harmony with everyone. It's associating with those considered of low position or unimportant. It's pouring out kindness even on our enemies. It's overcoming evil with good. It's pleasing our neighbors for their good, to build them up. For even Christ did not please himself. One of my favorite images comes from chapter 15. It's after a long discussion in chapter 14 of some issues that are dividing the church. And Paul is urging them, don't judge your brother or sister, don't judge another person's servant. Because it is that person who will make them stand or fall, and God will make them stand. But one of my favorite images comes in 15:7, where Paul boils it down to this: welcome one another then, just as Christ welcomed you, in order to bring praise to God. Just as Christ welcomed you. Now that's a big, warm welcome. I want to close with a story. I couldn't help but think of this verse when Paige pointed me to a great article not long ago. It's about this young lady. Her name is Natalie Hampton, 16 years old at the time the article came out, from Sherman Oaks, California. And she is the designer of a new app that launched in September called Sit With Us. That is her app. Here's the birthplace of this app. In seventh grade, every day at lunch, she found herself sitting alone, never welcomed to the table of another, which also left her open, not just to being excluded, but to being picked on and bullied. And she left that school and went to another school, and she found a warm welcome there and friends there, but she never forgot that experience of what it was like to always be on the outside looking in, to be excluded from friendship and connection and love. And so she designed this wonderful app, at least the concept is fantastic, the Sit With Us app, that students can sign themselves up as an ambassador, and they post on the app that they've got an open table. And anyone at school, all they have to do is click on the app, and they can see, where's the place of welcome? Where's the place of inclusion? Where's the place of friendship? Where's the place of love? There wasn't a wandering around, will I be accepted? Will I be rejected? Will I be humiliated? Will I be made fun of? Just this constant openness, this constant welcome. I can't help but think that when the church is really living out her call to love, that's the picture of who we are. We are indebted to the love of God. And so we never pay off that debt, to love one another as Christ has loved us. When we are at our best, that's a picture of who we are. Our love heals, our love helps, our love builds, our love unites, our love restores. Our love welcomes all, because Christ is the one who says there is always more room at the table. Let's stand and sing together.